I spent a few minutes with our friend Terry at Stonegate a few days ago, and first he wanted me to let you know that he loves you all. He can't wait to be back with us. He's thankful for your prayers, and he is very much looking forward to being back with us in worship once he regains his strength. But Terry unknowingly gave me a really good introduction to our message today. On his way to Stonegate, he had to spend some time at another facility, and he had a roommate who had lost the use of one arm and one leg. And this man was bitter about it, to the point where he refused to call an aide to help him get up and go to the bathroom. So whenever he felt the urge, he just went. As you can imagine, that's pretty unpleasant for someone that's sleeping in a bed right next to you, right? It was unpleasant for Terry. It was even more unpleasant for the workers that had to tend to him. And this wasn't a situation where it was accidental or a consequence of being at the end of life. Like, those things happen, right? That was not this. This is because you get a grown man who's able to communicate, able to ask for help, but outwardly admits he refuses to. He just refuses to work with people to make the situation better for everyone involved. He refused the help that could have changed the pattern, while continuing to depend on others to deal with its consequences. And for what purpose? I think that's probably the question that we should ask the most, is when you come across a story like that, the biggest question is why? What is the purpose behind this? And for him, it was just so he could do it all over again. That's really the only place that I could kind of come to. This is the story, though, of faith for so many people. We hear about God's rescue in Christ Jesus. Traditions like the sinner's prayer, altar calls, and even the sacred act of baptism have been coupled with promises of God's forgiveness of sin, but with no intentions of discipleship beyond those moments. Christians call on God to clean up the mess that they have made. Why? In order to do what? Far too often the answer is to make a mess all over again. The question we ask most frequently is, has God rescued you? Or maybe more commonly, are you saved? Do you believe? But the question that Psalm 18 is going to ask us today goes beyond that. It's asking us not what we've been saved from, but what are you saved to? Not have you believed, but are you still believing? Not have you been rescued, but what has God rescued you for? This psalm starts in a place that we're in today. It starts in worship. And in verses 1 through 3 of Psalm 18, David writes, "I love you, Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer, my God, my rock where I seek refuge, my shield, and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I called to the Lord who is worthy of praise, and I was saved from my enemies." He starts here because David is remembering where he came from. How many of you attribute a large part of your life to where you came from? "I was taught that way. This is how I was raised. This is what I've had to battle. These are my experiences." And all of those things, we remember them and they shape us going forward, right? Absolutely they do. And so what David has chosen to remember, because we can choose what we remember or what becomes a big influence on us, what he has chosen to remember is where he's come from. He's starting here because his heartbeat is, "I'm standing today because God, you have been my rock, you have been my fortress, you have been my deliverer, my refuge, and my shield." That is something that we as a people aren't too great at doing today. Looking back, grateful at what God has already saved us from. Our faith today seems to be more excited about what God will do. Would you agree or disagree with me on that? Yeah, we're way more excited about what God is going to continue to do than what God has already done. That alone is something to meditate on. It's something to reflect on. We naturally want to see things move forward and get better. And I know, especially for guys, once we've completed one adventure or achieved one goal, usually another one quickly comes in behind it, right? Like, there's always a project. There's always something we're going to do. There's always the next thing to accomplish and to feel like a man, right? But here, David isn't thinking about progress. David isn't thinking about progress. He's thinking about where he would be if God had not stepped in the way that he did. He may still have, as he's writing this, enemies that surround him, challenges that are in front of him, sin that haunts him. But he's remembering what God has already done. Yes, that fuels hope for future rescue, and it provides a baseline for trust in battles that are to come. But it also creates something more elusive today. Contentment. Peace. And even joy. And that remembering is what fuels his worship at the outset of this song. Our worship of God is not fueled by a melody or a crafted moment. It is powered by the all-powerful God who is mighty to save, who has saved. And then David moves into his story. After a moment of worship, he's moving into his testimony, his story. Verses 4 and 5, he says, "The ropes of death were wrapped around me. The torrents of destruction terrified me. The ropes of Sheol entangled me. The snares of death confronted me." I hope you're not feeling this way today, but if you are, there's hope, all right? Because David was trapped. He was afraid. He was staring death in the face. David, first thing to note here probably is that David is not naming physical enemies. There's no name, there's no person, there's no group of people, there's nothing he's named. Who is the enemy that he's named? Death. He's named death. Sheol is another name for death. The snares of death, the ropes of death, the torments of destruction, which is death, terrified me. The enemy that he is naming is death. There may have been physical faces. There may have been very real circumstances, but David isn't naming them. He's naming death itself. The ultimate and the unstoppable enemy, death that threatens every dream, death that cancels relationships, death that wants to end every comfort, every experience, every form of love, every bit of trust, death that comes for the soul of a person even while they are still breathing. Has anyone ever felt that kind of death before? You've lived with that death, haven't you? You have felt trapped and snared like destruction is the only way out. You have lived in death. And each of these things can be inflicted by physical sources, but death itself would not be possible without the supernatural foe that leads people away from the author of life. So first thing that you need to understand is that death is the enemy. Whether you feel it in your body, whether you see it with your eyes, whether you feel it with the wickedness of the world, death seeks to undo everything that God does. Fear, anxiety, illness, broken relationships, traumatic loss all remind us that death's shadow reaches far beyond the cemetery. They are not all the same, and they do not always come from personal sin. But each reveals its own way, and that the world is not yet as God intended it to be. Death is not merely the moment a heart stops beating. Its shadow appears whenever life is diminished, distorted, severed, or turned away from its creator. And so you must understand that you are living in a world that often markets death as life. It advertises bondage as freedom and self-destruction as self-expression. Our enemy is death, and behind it stands the father of lies who is continually leading people away from the author and the giver of life. And then David says this in verse 6. He says, "I called to the Lord in my distress, and I cried to my God for help. From his temple he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears." There is one solution, church. There is one solution for death in any of its forms. And I mean that. Not just the loss of physical life, but the loss of a dream, the loss of a marriage or a relationship, the loss of comfort, the loss of what you hoped life would look like. All of that is wrapped up in the bigger image of death. And there's only one source of peace, one source of contentment, one source that will help you come to that coveted place of acceptance, even if you never forget the pain. God is that source. God is that source. And David, by example, shows us that the response to any kind of death knocking on our door is to cry out to the Lord in our distress, because he will hear. He will hear. And we're going to see that God will draw near. I'm not into the emotional manipulation thing, but I so badly wanted to play like cinematic music behind the rest of this psalm, all right? Because if you think about that, if you would just imagine that, right? Like, this reads like a movie. This is pretty cool. And if you need encouragement today, this is a psalm that you need to return to, maybe even later in the day. Verse 7 in Psalm 18. Then, everybody say then. Then the earth shook and quaked. Can you hear the strings building in the background of the movie, right? The foundations of the mountains trembled. They shook because he burned with anger. Smoke rose from his nostrils. That's cool, isn't it? Smoke rose from his nostrils, and consuming fire came from his mouth. Coals were set ablaze by it. He bent the heavens and came down. Total darkness beneath his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew, soaring on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his hiding place, dark storm clouds his canopy around him. From the radiance of his presence, his clouds swept onward with hail and blazing coals. Can you imagine that? Hail falling at the same time as hot coals. That is a sight, right? The Lord thundered from heaven. The Most High made his voice heard. He shot his arrows and scattered them. He hurled lightning bolts and routed them. The depths of the sea became visible. Where have we seen that before? Exodus. Red Sea, right? The depths of the sea became visible. The foundations of the world were exposed. At your rebuke, Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils, he reached down from on high and took hold of me. He pulled me out of deep water. He rescued me from my powerful enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too strong for me. They confronted me in my day of calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out to a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. I got goosebumps. I don't know about you. Maybe it doesn't mean as much to you, but I got some goosebumps reading that. And I've been studying it all week, right? It reads like a movie script. The earth shakes. The mountain quakes. The smoke rises from God's nostrils. So we know that God has a nose, right? No, this is poetic. So, and consuming fire came from his mouth. God bends the heavens and comes down hiding in the darkness. He's sending forth hail and coals, and he makes his voice heard. He shoots arrows and hurls lightning bolts. He's cooler than Thor, guys. Like, this is awesome. And the sea floor becomes visible. And God himself, listen, God himself came to rescue one man. This is what it feels like for David. That God did all of this, put on this display of power just for him. To be his support, to bring him out to a spacious place. And note the last verse that we just read there. The giant display of God's power was motivated by God's delight. Motivated by God's delight. He rescued me because he delighted in me. Some of you need to remember that this morning. He didn't rescue you because of what you could produce. He didn't rescue you because of what kind of a person you are. He didn't rescue you because of what you could potentially achieve in life. He didn't rescue you because you're special. He rescued you because he delights in you. Some of you need to remember that God does, in fact, want you. He doesn't need you. He doesn't just put up with you. He doesn't look at you out of the corner of his eye and just wait for you to get better, right? He delights in you like a parent delights in their children. And so when you cry out to him, he will hear you. He will hear you. He will not abandon you. His rescue may not take the shape that you imagined or arrive on the timetable that you wanted, but death will not have the final word over anyone who belongs to Christ. And like a child, it is often that we don't know what's best for us. I kind of hate to burst your bubble, and I know some of you won't accept those words, but it is often that you don't know what's best for you. Thank you. Because, church, sometimes our dreams are dangerous, right? And sometimes they're selfish and we don't even know it. And the evidence is that that already in your past, looking over your story, your testimony, you can see things that you did that you would never do now because you see how short-sighted or maybe self-centered they are. Am I speaking truth this morning? So sometimes, listen, I need you to hear this, some of you. Sometimes God's rescue does not look like support. Sometimes God's rescue does not look like rescue in that moment. But he is. He's still writing the story. And you need to trust him. You need to trust him. Sometimes it feels like you're hanging on for dear life. That rope's got one little strand left, and you're like, it's going to break at any minute. And if I don't let go, I'm not going to survive, right? Don't let go. Do not let go. He is strong and able to save. He will save. God will rescue you from the ultimate enemy of death with an incredible display of power. And look, everybody wants that rescue. Everybody wants that rescue. Nobody objects to that kind of a rescue. If you're drowning in debt, nope, you're not going to refuse somebody who comes up and says, hey, I'm going to pay off your debt. You might fight them for a second, but inside you're really like, please, 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 right? Yeah. Right? I got a pastor friend over in Owosso, and we battle every single time to buy each other's lunch when we get together, right? Gave me a plan. But it doesn't matter. We always fight to pay for it. But there are days when maybe we've had an expense, or maybe there's something we didn't manage well that month or whatever. And I'm kind of like, I hope he pays. You know, like, I still try to get my card out there, but I'm like, kind of hope he does, you know? You're laughing because you know it's true, right? You've been in that same dang situation. Everybody wants that rescue. And while you may feign objection, you're not going to object to that rescue. But church, rescue is not the end. We're not done with the sermon yet. We've got like 30 more verses, right? Y'all are like, seriously? Yeah. We're going to buzz through them, all right? Don't worry. I took this as a personal challenge today to not keep you past noon. So we're gonna try. But... I need you to hear this. Rescue is not the end of the Christian life. I'm going to say it again. Rescue is not the end of the Christian life. We treat it as if it is. God saved me and my sins are now washed away and I am free. Period. Right? It's not the end of the Christian life. Conversion is not the finish line. We do not somehow arrive the moment God pulls us up from the water. Rescue, then, church, is the doorway. It's the doorway. We're going to read 10 more verses. The Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness. He repaid me according to the cleanness of my hands. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not turned from my God to wickedness. Indeed, I let all his ordinances guide me and have not disregarded his statutes. I was blameless toward him and kept myself from my iniquity. So the Lord repaid me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. You nailed the worship songs this week. With the faithful, you prove your faithful. You prove yourself faithful. With the blameless, you prove yourself blameless. With the pure, you prove yourself pure. But with the crooked, you prove yourself shrewd. For you rescue an oppressed people, but you humble those with haughty eyes. Lord, you light my lamp. My God illuminates my darkness. With you, I can attack a barricade, and with my God, I can leap over a wall. God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is pure. He is a shield to all who take refuge in him. Now, very different flavor from what we just read a minute ago, right? I've noticed that what happens in my heart sometimes when I hear scripture like this, something kind of gets a little bit like, okay, David, goody two shoes guy over here, right? Like it kind of feels like he's boasting a little bit. It feels that way. And the Apostle Paul will do it too at times. John talks about how he beat Peter in a foot race, right? Like there are these moments in Scripture where we kind of see the humanity coming through. And these words may make us uncomfortable because we know that David was not sinless, right? Like he talks about how I kept myself pure and I stayed away from my iniquity. But we're like, yeah, but Bathsheba, man. Like, what are you can't claim all of this. So we know David wasn't sinless. And because we know, we aren't either. But David is not celebrating perfection. I need you to understand this as we walk through this. David isn't celebrating perfection. He's celebrating that in this particular trial, God enabled him to remain faithful when compromise would have been easier. David's main enemy for a while was Saul. You recognize that name a little bit? Yeah. His enemy for a while was Saul. He was the one that was after David. He was the one that wanted David dead. And David had multiple chances himself to kill Saul. He had multiple chances to kill Saul. Nobody would have blamed David if he had killed Saul. Even his own men encouraged him to do it, and it would have solved nearly all of his problems. Please keep that in mind. But David refused. He refused to do it. Why? Because he would rather wait on God to accomplish God's promise than to accomplish God's promise through sinful means. David is not claiming that he never sinned. He is speaking about his conduct in the middle of this struggle. When Saul pursued him, David refused to seize through sin what God had promised to give in God's time. God was reshaping David then. God rescued David, but now he's reshaping David through each of these trials that he goes through. Over and over again, when David had to run, when David had the opportunity, David chose to stand firm in the Lord. He chose to follow the Lord. And so God wasn't only saving David from Saul. He wasn't just saving him from the external circumstances that were around him. God was saving David from becoming another Saul. Please see that. When God didn't eliminate Saul immediately, God was rescuing David in his heart of hearts. He was doing work each time David went into the basement of his emotions that we've been through so far. This is Psalm 18. We've got like 130 some more to go. Right? Every summer till I'm retired, you know? Like, yeah. But every time he goes there, God was doing his rescuing work in David's heart, in his soul, in his mind. He was clarifying, he was maturing, he was reinforcing God's own character in David. Each time David wrestled with God, he came out looking more like God because he chose to stay faithful to God. And church, isn't that what God does with us? God doesn't just rescue us from addiction. He reshapes our desires. Right? Like, he doesn't just rescue our marriages. He reshapes husbands and wives. He doesn't simply rescue us from greed. He reshapes what we treasure. He doesn't simply rescue us from anger. He reshapes our hearts. The rescue begins to change the rescued. And God can change our outer worlds, and sometimes he does choose to do it that way. Absolutely. But more often, God uses our outer world to change our inner world. See, some people want forgiveness, but they don't want to be formed. Some people love grace, but they resist transformation. And so what happens is the grace of God just becomes a reset button. Now, I don't want to diminish that God is a God of second chances, but church, grace is not just God's permission to begin again. It is, but it's not only that. Grace is God's power to become someone new. The sweetest part of God's grace, you know that you have trusted in God's grace. When you can come to God right after sin, or maybe even in the midst of sin, and say, God, I know this isn't who you want me to be anymore. But I can't shake this. I can't fix this. I have failed you again, but God, I rest on the fact that you knew about this when you included me in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So finish the work you started in me. Get rid of the death that lives in me. Because what David says, with you I can attack a barricade. I can leap over a wall. You are my shield. God doesn't rescue us so that we can keep living the same way. He opens the door to become someone new. And God does not reshape us so that we can become private examples of spiritual improvement. He releases us to the people, to the responsibilities, to the places where his character needs to become visible. In this last section here, David is still remembering, but his testimony now turns toward the life that God has equipped him to live after the strengthening, after the reshaping. The God who rescued and reshaped him also trained, strengthened, and released him into his calling. And so it's a little different, but we're just going to read right to the end of the psalm, starting at verse 31. He says, "For who is God besides the Lord? And who is a rock? Only our God. God, he clothes me with strength and makes my way perfect. He makes my feet the feet of a deer and sets me securely on the heights. He trains my hands for war. My arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have given me the shield of your salvation. Your right hand upholds me and your humility exalts me. You make me a spacious place beneath me. I'm sorry, you make a spacious place beneath me for my steps, and my ankles do not give way. I pursue my enemies and overtake them. I do not turn back until they are wiped out." Guys, you feel the testosterone building in you right now? I crush them and cannot get up. They fall beneath my feet. You have clothed me with strength for battle. You subdue my adversaries beneath me. You have made my enemies retreat before me. I annihilate those who hate me. They cry for help, but there is no one to save them. They cry to the Lord, but he does not answer them. I pulverize them like dust before the wind. I trample them like mud in the streets. You have freed me from the feuds among the people. You have appointed me the head of nations, a people that I had not known serve me. Foreigners submit to me, cringing. As soon as they hear, they obey me. Foreigners lose heart and come trembling from their fortifications. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. The God of my salvation is exalted. God, he grants me vengeance and subdues peoples under me. He frees me from my enemies. You exalt me above my adversaries. You rescue me from violent men. Therefore, I will give thanks to you among the nations, Lord. I will sing praises about your name. He gives great victories to his king. He shows loyalty to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. Whew, right? That's a little different. In God's reshaping of David, God has strengthened David. He has trained David. He has quick and steady feet. He has hands that are skilled. And keep in mind, this is poetry, right? So these are all images, imagery that's supposed to bring to mind a bigger picture. His path has widened. He has learned that whatever God has called him to face, he will not face it in his own strength. Listen, here, David is not merely trying to be righteous anymore. David is trained in righteousness. He allowed God to reshape him. He submitted to the training of the wilderness, the sleepless nights, the running from people who were supposedly his people. He wrestled with God and chose to learn from God. And he didn't just try, he trained. And God releases him to serve God's people. Now think about that. He didn't just keep trying to be righteous, he trained himself in righteousness. You can go and try to run a marathon this afternoon. You can try and pick up one of the instruments up here and try and play it. You can try and insert an IV in someone, right? Or you can try and fix a car. But most of you are not trained in any of those things. So either the result is going to be poor or you're not even going to try. Is that accurate? Yeah, some of you are musicians, some of you can do some of these things, but not all of them, right? Because you're not trained in them. God rescued you because he delights in you. Most of our lives won't amount to the legendary status that God has David in. That's okay, because that's not the point. But so many Christians have come to the doorway that God's rescue brings and they won't step through. They won't step into the reshaping, the training that God has in store for them. And what that does is it keeps you in survival mode, church. That keeps you in survival mode. Instead of putting on a scuba tank, you've just got the scuba mask with a little straw, right? And you can do some cool things with that. You can feel, explore a new world with that, but you can't go as deep as you want to go without that tank on your back, right? Without the training, without the wetsuit. You can't get down far enough. And folks, that's kind of the Christian life here. If you won't step through that door, you're not going to see how deep this rabbit hole goes. You're not going to experience the depth of God's grace. You're just going to keep hitting that reset button. And for those of you that have struggled with your weight, for those of you that have tried to acquire a new skill and keep kind of failing at it, you've got to keep hitting that reset button. How discouraging is it to hit the reset button, right? You get an electronic device and all of a sudden it acts up and you got to push that little tiny reset button in it with a paperclip, right? and it messes everything up, and you got to spend the next 3 hours figuring out how it works. It is, you can keep doing that. And God's grace is sufficient for that. But you're just living in what God has saved you from, not what God has saved you to. And that's why you're constantly in survival mode. Because you're living like the world while crying out to Jesus all the time. You're like, I don't understand why my life isn't getting any better. So often we look at obedience to God as the price of God's rescue. Because God didn't just rescue David in order to survive and get through life. God rescued David to lead. The goal isn't simply, I made it. The goal is, I can now serve my king. I can serve my God. I can serve the throne. I can see the kingdom expand. God has rescued people who are now grandparents, who are now parents, who are now neighbors, employees, church members, and his rescue wasn't just for their benefit. His character becomes visible through them. His rescue isn't just for your benefit, it's so that his character can become visible through you. It was ironic this morning, as just scrolling Facebook real quick before I came upstairs to practice, and a pastor had posted on there that we represent Jesus. We represent Jesus to the world. We're called to remind people of the gospel, right? So when we represent Jesus, it feels like an obligation that I have to. It's the price of God's rescue. That's what we amount it to. But obedience isn't the price of God's rescue. It's the purpose of God's rescue. God has rescued you from eternal death, but God has also rescued from the death that leads to sin that humans choose to create with their words, with their attitudes, with their actions. He rescued you so that you wouldn't have to keep living through the same consequences, the same broken relationships, the same spiraling thoughts. He rescued you from the system of the world and all of its shoddy wisdom. And he has given you his wisdom. He has given you the fear of the Lord. And hopefully, when we came to Jesus and we said, I surrender all, that meant that I'm going to leave behind what experience has taught me, and I'm going to embrace what the Lord teaches me. What does that look like? He's trying to train you for holy living. Not to keep you in a box, not to restrict you from all of the pleasures that are in the world. As we often say, God puts boundaries on what we are able to do with our bodies. He puts boundaries on what we are supposed to steward in this world. He puts boundaries on these things. And he's trying to train you in holy living. Not the whole Christians are nice kind of thing. Like, everybody has a Christian shouldn't say things, they shouldn't offend people, they should be doormats, they should be just the people that we extract things from when they need them, you know, that kind of situation. That's not what we're talking about. I'm talking about stewarding what God has given to you. So your body that the New Testament calls God's temple, God puts boundaries on what we're able to do with our bodies, what we should be doing with our bodies. Everything from food to sex to substances to what we look at, listen to, what comes out of our bodies. He says he has commands surrounding how we steward our possessions, to be disciplined with our money, to not get too attached to the treasures of this world. He calls us to steward our relationships, to love and serve the people that are in your life, to have people around for confession of sin so that you can tangibly feel the forgiveness of God and gain wisdom from their wrestling with the Lord. We often think of this kind of obedience as the price we pay to get into heaven. Church, no! Because behind every command is the promise of life and the extermination of death. Now, God's commands do not shield us from every illness, loss, or broken relationship. Faithful people will still suffer, but His commands keep us from adding needless destruction to suffering that is already present in this world. Financial discipline can't prevent every hardship, but it can loosen greed's grip and prepare us to live generously. Could you imagine what it would feel like for you to hear about a need and be able to be like, yeah, I can take care of that, instead of doing all the math in your brain or thinking, man, I don't have enough money for myself to get to the end of the month. Wouldn't that feel awesome? Sexual integrity can't guarantee an easy life, but it protects us from treating our bodies and other people as consumable items. It trains us to think of people as the image of God. Relational faithfulness cannot eliminate every conflict, but it teaches us to confess, to forgive, to listen, and to love instead of continually multiplying wounds. And this is why the psalm cannot just end with David becoming a better man. Look again at his closing thought at verse 50. He says, "He gives great victories to his king. He shows loyalty to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever." David realizes that his rescue was never only about him. God was preserving his anointed king. God was keeping his promise, and God was carrying forward a story that would extend beyond David's lifetime, beyond David's kingdom, and eventually lead to Jesus. What would it look like to not just give lip service to the fact that the kids that are going to be at VBS, the kids that are in our church now, the kids that are in our community, the ones that have been making beautiful noises all throughout this service? Right? Yes! Absolutely! What if we didn't just give lip service to that we need more kids in our church? What if we actually became trained in righteousness so that we could be the example when they needed us to be? Does that make sense? Because they're going to be watching all of you. It doesn't matter if you want to lead or not. They're watching you. When guests come into our church and they see how you interact with your spouse, with your kids, with other people in this church, when they see what you do, how you serve, how you present the gospel, how you talk about the Bible, how you talk about your very life, they are learning cues from you of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. You are leading whether you like it or not. You are teaching, whether you like it or not. You are showing, you are representing, you are reminding people of what Jesus is like, whether you like it or not. Because the story doesn't end with you. It's not God rescued me, period. David has been surrounded by the ropes of death, but Jesus entered death itself. David could speak of righteousness in one particular struggle, but Jesus was righteous in every struggle. David refused to seize a kingdom through sinful means, but Jesus refused every shortcut that was ever offered to him and remained obedient all the way to the cross. David was raised from the wilderness and placed upon a throne. Jesus was raised from the grave and exalted as eternal king. David defeated enemies that could threaten his life. Jesus defeated sin and death itself, the enemies that threaten every life. And that means that our hope today is not that we can become righteous enough to earn God's rescue. Our hope is that the righteous King has already come. He entered our death, He carried our sin, and Jesus rose in victory. And now everyone who takes refuge in Him can be forgiven, they can be reshaped, they can be strengthened, they can be given a place in the kingdom. Church, Jesus did not rise from the grave so that we could keep returning to the same old tombs. He didn't free us from sin so that we could continue arranging our lives around sin. He didn't forgive us just so that we could feel better about yesterday while refusing to follow Him today. He rescued us so that we could walk in the newness of life. Maybe the question for you today is, where do I need God to rescue me? That very well may be a real question for you. But I think for many of us, there is a harder question that presents itself. Where am I asking God to clean up the consequences while refusing the help that would change the pattern? Where do I keep praying for peace while continuing to make decisions that produce chaos? Where do I ask God to repair relationships while refusing to confess, forgive, to listen, or change? Where do I ask God to free me from temptation while continuing to feed the desire? Where do I celebrate grace but resist discipleship? Church, God's grace is not God agreeing to repeatedly clean up a life that we have no intention of surrendering. Grace is God reaching down into the deep water, taking hold of us, pulling us into a spacious place, and teaching us how to walk there. God rescues, God reshapes, and God releases. He rescues because he delights in us. He reshapes because he loves us too much to leave death ruling inside of us. And he releases us because there are people, there are responsibilities, there are places where the life of Jesus must become visible. I don't know about you, but I don't want the summary of my life with Jesus to be, I survived. I will survive. Right? We're not doing that. I want to faithfully steward what God has entrusted to me. I want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant. Christian, step into the life for which Jesus has rescued you. Stop pushing the reset button. Step into the life. Embrace the responsibility. Surrender yourself to him. Train yourself in righteousness, and God has promised he will not let the work he started in you go unfinished. Let him train your heart. Let him steady your feet. Let him strengthen your hands. Let him make his character visible through your words, through your body, your possessions, your relationships, and your service. Obedience is not the price of God's rescue. It's the purpose of God's rescue. And the God who began this work in you is still strong enough to finish it.